So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe. Frische Netzsekt, verschiedene Sorten, je 0,75 Liter Flasche nur 3,49 Euro. Und außerdem Emira Klettscheiben, Natur, je 200 Gramm Packung nur 2,22 Euro. Sichere dir außerdem bis zum 24. Dezember 10% Rewe Bonusguthaben auf Weihnachtssüßwaren. Nur in deiner Rewe-App. Frohe Weihnachten. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey, and joining me as always is my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello. Sorry in advance for the crackly sounds. My cat decided now is the time to start using the scratching post.
Well, right now there's street construction happening just outside my window, so there may be jackhammers and things.
That's a little louder than scratching.
Yeah, unfortunately, but so far so good, so fingers crossed that it doesn't get to be too bad. But Nadia, are you ready for E3?
No, are you?
I am, actually. I am ready for E3.
If you're not ready for E3, we're all screwed.
I've been steadily hyping myself up for E3 time because I guess, I don't know, when it comes to E3, there gets to be a point where I allow myself to be uncynically excited again, kind of like the kid who's going to be opening presents.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I'll be excited once we're like kind of into the, you know, the press conferences, particularly Nintendo and Square Enix's press conferences.
Yeah, it's going to sound so dorky, but I always have that kind of excitement when I'm walking into EA Play of all things for the first time, because I know I'm going to get to see the new sports games for the first time.
Yay, sports.
It's the one moment where I'm like uncritically excited because I can be excited for that moment of like, oh, maybe these will be really good. Maybe these will be the game changers. And then I can be disappointed and feeling let down later.
You always have to have that like obligatory letdown. The first E3 I went to was 2006. And that was actually a year I had a revelation. That was the year I was walking to the event with Sharky and Parrish. And I saw like Mountain Dew everywhere. And I'm like, what is up with Mountain Dew? And they're like, don't you have Mountain Dew in Canada? And I said, yeah, but no one cares. Nobody drinks it. And they're like, why? And that's when I learned Mountain Dew in the States had caffeine in it, a lot of caffeine in it. And we didn't have it like with caffeine in Canada. So I was like, oh, no wonder you guys are out of your minds.
Ugh, I'd rather drink crab juice.
Yeah, I definitely want to drink the crab juice. I hate Mountain Dew. Ugh.
E3 has changed quite a bit since 2006, I gotta say.
Yeah, just a little bit. When I look at big events like E3 and like PAX and stuff like that, and I go to it now, I'm like, wow, how do we ever do these events without smartphones?
I can't even imagine because I've become so reliant on my smartphone. I have to have a battery pack with me at all times because
absolutely.
I'm going to go through my entire battery at least once because it's my recorder. It keeps my schedule. It allows me to check the calendar and of course, Google Maps, like GPS. So
yeah, it's everything. And yeah, it has changed quite a bit from back when I was a lowly freelancer looking at this like developer called CD Projekt Red tucked away in this corner that no one really went to. Who are these guys?
Never catch on.
Nah. Witcher, who cares?
I think the biggest difference is in 2006, there were probably a lot of GameStop employees walking around.
Oh,
now they're who managed to get a free pass in and were telling all of their friends about the latest hands-on with Assassin's Creed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In 2019, those same people are influencers and live streamers.
Oh, God, they are, I guess. And I guess on the feeding chain, according to PR, they're probably above us.
So you'll just be seeing people running around with cameras frantically trying to get as much as possible. And then, of course, they allowed the masses into E3 last year. So
they did, the unwashed masses. Actually, I think I'm okay with it. It's crowded, but I don't think I've been to E3 since they've started doing that. I haven't been to E3 since 2011. I'm part of the home team again.
I was always jealous when Jeff Green would tell me about what it was like to cover E3 back in the 90s. And he said, you'd go to some appointments during the day, you go have dinner and drinks with developers and such at night, And then at the end of E3, you know, you'd go on a week-long vacation, then you'd come back and write the magazine.
Wow, magazines.
For the days when you weren't running around like a chicken with your head cut off, trying to get every last little nugget of interesting tidbits that you hope will get picked up by Resetera or Reddit.
Yeah, and then you're up at like ass o'clock at night writing in hopes that you get ahead of the crowd on whatever information you got.
All right, so we're going to be doing our E3 2019 preview today. As you might expect, we are less than 1 week away from getting into E3. We're going to hit all of the big topics that are coming up and hitting on some of the big RPGs that we are looking forward to. There are a few. There are several, in fact. So We'll be talking about all of that. We'll also be talking about all of the Pokemon news that dropped earlier this week and touching briefly on an interesting teaser from Larian Studios. You should, if you enjoy this podcast and you haven't subscribed, I recommend subscribing on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. We're pretty much everywhere. And if you enjoy the podcast, I strongly recommend that you leave a review, because if you leave a review, it will increase our visibility and such. And of course, follow me on Twitter at @_catbot, Nadia is @NadiaOxford, and subscribe to our newsletter. It goes out every Wednesday and includes a fun RPG-related topic. Okay, so Nadia, checking in really quickly, how is your Trails of Cold Steel playthrough going?
It's going quite well. I am on the Nord Highlands, and I think war stuff is starting to happen. And I've been kind of caught up playing Blades, which is like the in-game card game. And I'm terrible at it. And it's mostly a game of luck, so whatever. But I still like playing it. But yeah, I'm having a good time. I finally got to ride horses, even though I can't be part of the riding club. So, win.
You're also playing Persona Q, too.
Yes, I am. I know there's still some embargo on that, so there's probably can't talk about too much. But yes, I am playing that and kind of observing how it is the same and different from Etrian Odyssey, which is another series I'm still pretty new at. What's kind of strange, and maybe you won't expect me to hear this, I feel like Etrian Odyssey is a little bit easier than Persona Q, too. And that's because Etrian Odyssey gives you so much control over how you stylize your party and customize it versus Persona Q2, which I'm assuming is like the first one, in that you have your characters and they have their personas and they have their sub-personas. But outside of like, you know, maybe changing your party members around and rearranging your sub-personas, there's not nearly as much customization going on. And that's pretty interesting. Although I will say mapping is much easier in Persona Q, because it kind of tells you, it kind of previews where the walls are for you, so you can just take your styles and go do, and instead of having to, like, you know, make sure you're against a wall every time you draw in a line. But yeah, other than being a little bit difficult at times, and I'm starting to kind of get the hang of how this difficulty works and how, like, I need to customize my party, I'm actually enjoying it quite a bit. I finished the first, let's call it the first dungeon. The first stratum, whatever you want to call it.
What's funny is that my impression was that the original Persona Q was considerably easier than Etrian Odyssey.
Yeah, I can see why that would be the case, because, of course, Etrian Odyssey is dense as hell, and it is quite intimidating with how much leeway it gives you to customize your party. And if you don't customize the right kind of party, you could, you know, wind up dying. But yeah, it just surprised me, I guess because Etrian Odyssey gives you such a good outline of what each class is and what it does and what its skills are, and so you say to yourself, oh, okay, well, I'll just, you know, I'll build my party this way, and I have this person can be healing, this person can be buffing, and et cetera, whereas I guess maybe part of Persona's problem, too, is that I want certain characters in my party, and it's like, Haru, no, I don't want you, so well, I have the heal spell. I don't care. I don't want you in my party. You know what I mean?
My impression from Persona Q was that the insta-kill spells were really overpowered. So if you built the right party, you could basically just get through the major content really pretty fast, because you would be wiping out entire parties of enemies, or most of those parties, really, really fast.
Yeah, I think now that I'm getting more into Persona Q too, I am finding more effective ways to use my personas, my sub-personas as well. I don't think it's a spoiler to say you can't combine personas right away when you first start the game. You have to wait a little bit. So you have your default personas and a few crummy sub-personas. And once you start, you know, being able to mix them and have more control over what your spells are, like I only just finally got my first insta-kill spell, Hama. So now that I have that, yes, I can use it against things like, you know, rare personas that give me lots of good items to build with and lots of, like, you know, money to build stuff with. And I think that counts for a lot.
Well, I'm in the process of playing Final Fantasy VII still. It's become a little bit of an impromptu Final Fantasy VII report, Nadia.
That's okay with me. I'm okay with that. I think other people are okay with that, too.
So I got through the Shinra building, finally, and I had my big fight with Rufus, who I love. He's such a douchebag.
Oh, he's great. I love that fight. Just on top of the building with the escape helicopter circling, and he has that dog thing that protects him.
Yeah, the dog will give him a shield or something like that.
Yeah, and I remember that just because the dog's name is Dark Nation.
Dark Nation?
It's called Dark Nation. And I'm like, what the hell is that? I love it.
And then when you're fighting Rufus and everything, so the President Shinra has died.
Yeah, he's got stabbed.
And it strikes me that they're doing a lot what they did in Final Fantasy VI, which was, in Final Fantasy VI, they set up Emperor Gestalt to be the main villain, with Kefka kind of be there on the side.
Right.
In this one, President Shinra is the big bad of Midgar.
Yes.
Which you might call the initial arc of Final Fantasy VII. But then, of course, Sephiroth, the true big bad, shows up and kills him.
Yes.
And the whole sequence in which you are put in jail, and then you wake up, and there's the trail of blood that you have to follow to get into the office, and you see President Shinra has the katana through him and everything, and the freaky, you know, experiment that you were looking at is gone. I thought that whole sequence was really well done.
Yeah, I think the trail of blood is still creepy as hell combined with the music they have going on in that sequence.
Yeah, and this game is really atmospheric. I would go as far as to say it's easily the most atmospheric of all the Final Fantasy games.
Yes, I will easily concede to that. That's one thing that struck me when I replayed the game for the first time years and years ago, because of course I played it in 97, then I played it again in like 2000-something, and I'm like, wow, this game's not perfect, but it has atmosphere like hell.
And then after you beat Rufus and you get Aeris and you're escaping out of Shinra, there's that really exciting and fun chase with the motorcycle, and everybody gets into... Emily was like, is that like a tuk-tuk with the little truck that everybody else jumps into? Because she's like, why does it have only three wheels?
The little European car? Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so, and I mean, obviously the motorcycle chase doesn't hold up. I hope that it looks a lot better in Final Fantasy VII Remake if they decide to retain it.
Yeah, I think I told you this. We were recently talking about Akira, the movie, on the Slack channel, and that whole sequence is definitely, like, all of Final Fantasy VII is Akira, the video game, but that particular sequence is like, oh, okay, they wanted to be the opening motorcycle scene with the clowns and Kaneda's gang. So yeah, that's what that is, I think. And I remember playing that sequence a lot as a kid, because I would, you know, you can play it again in the Gold Saucer if you want, but playing it now, I'm like, oh, God, this isn't very good.
And I like the little moment at the end of the chase where they're literally at the end of the road in Midgar.
I love that. I still love that very much. With just, they're kind of on the bridge, like looking out and wondering what they do now. That's a great sequence.
Yeah, and they're looking out into the distance, and I guess it's either twilight or morning is coming.
Yeah.
And you can see the lights flashing and everything, and there's kind of this reflective music, and they're like, okay, we got to keep going. I thought that was really well done as well.
Especially since playing for the first time, that's when I was just like blown away to discover, wow, this is only a tiny sliver of the game. Now the world opens up to me.
Yeah, it's a big reveal. And one thing, I mean, it was obvious, but I didn't notice. Man, they really are pushing the whole Midgar is a total blight on the world, because when you step out of it, it's super dark.
It's all dark and polluted, and the ground around you is like literally like stripped of all life.
I think it's interesting that Midgar is just this one gigantic city sitting right there, but then around it is really rural.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Like, the next place you visit is Calm, which is a very sort of, almost like a very European-looking town.
Yeah, it's surrounded by a lot of tiny European hamlets, I want to say, with barely any infrastructure, no roads, etc.
Yeah, and I think that actually ties surprisingly well into the story, because if I'm not mistaken, this game takes place, you know, just a handful of years after Shinra has kind of conquered the world, and they're moving their influence in there really fast. So yeah, you still have these towns that are, like, as we say, European and rural, but they're talking about new stuff, like, oh, this new Mako reactor they're installing. Oh, Mako makes everything so much more convenient now.
And then you get to Calm, and this is where you learn about Sephiroth for the first time, because Cloud is having his big flashback. And again, another sequence that is extremely well done, because while in some ways it makes the story grind to a halt so that we can get some exposition, I think it's really effective exposition, because it does a great job of introducing Sephiroth as a character who should be reckoned with, and seeing his descent into madness is genuinely chilling.
Yes, and I think one of the, frankly, one of the best bits of visual storytelling I've seen in Final Fantasy, or maybe any game ever, is just that opening where the truck hits the green dragon that you're supposed to go kill, and this green dragon is, first of all, it's huge, and back then it was, like, just incredible to see big, huge enemy models where we're so used to, like, sprites, and this dragon, you know, one-shots usually Cloud, whereas Sephiroth takes literally one swipe and it's dead. That's just, to me, saying, wow, okay, this character is not to be trifled with.
That's also the first time you get to see the full spells, Fire 3 and Ice 3 and such.
And of course he has them.
And you're like, whoa, that looks incredible, you know, circa 1997 or whatever. I just really liked the entire sequence in the mansion, which is appropriately eerie, and seeing Sephiroth going through all the different books and clearly falling into madness as he realizes just who and what he is.
Yeah. That's really well done. You see the books, like, piling up beside him as Cloud kind of narrates how the lights never went out in the mansion after that.
Yeah. And then we see that, I guess, Shinra has been creating monsters using Mako?
Yeah, it's, the problem with the translation in this game, it's not 100% clear, but that does seem to be the implication, and I think Sephiroth is, like, worried that he's also one of those monsters, but he's much sexier than any of the monsters.
Is the idea that he's supposed to be... Are they supposed to be people who are getting overexposed to Mako and turned into monsters?
That's the impression I get. And I think at one point I looked at the Final Fantasy Wiki for an explanation of this, because, of course, I'm sure one of the supplementary games went into it in way too much detail. But yes, I believe, like, an overexposure to Mako will do that to you, among other... detrimental effects, as you'll learn later in the story, of course.
So they remind me of reverse mermaids.
You're right. They had, like, the fish on top and then the legs on the bottom.
It's the wrong way around.
Well, it sure is creepy.
So, it's all... And, of course, the infamous scene in which Nibelheim is on fire, and then you see Sephiroth looking out through the fire and all of that. That is also perfectly effective. I tweeted this, that Final Fantasy VII has been way better than I remembered so far. I've been really enjoying it.
Yeah, every time I play through the game, and I have played through it, like, many times, I really like it, barring a few parts where I'm like, oh god, this is a terrible idea. But yeah, generally, it's one of my favorite Final Fantasies, and I am vindicated, because it's always been one of my favorite Final Fantasies.
I do think the combat is a little boring, not because I dislike turn-based, but because... I think it's a shade too repetitive, and there's not a lot of tactics or strategy to it.
Yeah, I do feel like combat is a step down from Final Fantasy VI, which gave us the character unique skills. Limit breaks aren't really a replacement for those.
Yeah, Final Fantasy VI's combat was almost immediately more interesting than Final Fantasy VII just from the start.
Final Fantasy VI kind of forced you to use combat effectively as early as... I think it's one of the first missions in the game where you beat up one of Sabin's old classmates, and you have to use one of his techniques. And if you don't use his technique, you can't win the battle. So that's just a way of teaching you how to use it.
Yeah, except they don't teach you how to use the actual command. So I guess you got to look in the manual or something.
I got stuck on that for a while, yeah.
I was actually on that very segment right now in Final Fantasy VI when I started a new game on Super Nintendo. And I was like, but they didn't tell me what the damn command is.
Woolsey!
I don't know how much more I'm going to keep playing. I might keep playing just so that I have a frame of reference when Remake comes out.
That's not a bad idea.
But I would, if you haven't tried it out on Switch, that's a great place to play it, especially since they fixed the music bug.
Yes, they fixed the music bug. I haven't checked since they fixed it, but I'm glad they did.
But if Final Fantasy VII keeps it up, it might actually overtake Final Fantasy VIII and become my favorite PlayStation Final Fantasy.
Gasp.
Yeah, I might even put it ahead of the PS2 games, because I'm going to be honest, like, I don't think Final Fantasy X has aged all that well, but maybe I need to play that one next. Maybe I'm just going to be on a trip where I play all the Final Fantasy games again, rather than, yeah, I don't know, well, finishing Persona 5.
Well, you may as well wait for Persona 5 R at the end of the day.
No, I'm not going to. I'm going to finish the damn game. I'm not starting over, Nadia. I've come too far.
I guess you have, yeah. It's like, yeah, you're several palaces in. You don't want to start over again. I'm probably going to play it all over again, though.
All right, let's talk about some Pokemon news. There was a whole mess of Pokemon news that came out last week. I believe it was last Tuesday. And here is some of it. Pokemon Sleep, Nadia.
No, like I said on Twitter, Sleep, that's where I'm a Snorlax.
So Game Freak isn't content to own you during the day and every other waking hour. No, they got to have you while you're asleep as well.
I wonder how this, like, as I understand, this isn't, like, something you put on your phone, directly, because research will tell you that, you know, checking your phone before bed is a terrible thing to do for your rhythm, although everyone does it anyway. It's like a little accessory, isn't it? Like, that it kind of hooks up to your phone.
Yeah, it reminds me of a Fitbit kind of situation.
Yeah.
In which, so I have a Fitbit, and it monitors my bodily rhythms or whatever, and in the morning I can check a little app. And it will tell me how much I slept and everything.
Huh.
So I think they're going to do that with Pokemon, and they're going to find a way to gamify it.
How do you... Okay, I don't have a Fitbit, but like I'm kind of thinking of this in a Pokemon context, because I think the footage showed someone putting the little device beside them. Do you have to put the Fitbit and devices like that beside you as you sleep?
No, it's on my wrist.
Oh, God. How do you sleep with that on your wrist?
It's just like a watch. You don't even notice it after a while.
I don't even like to sleep with watches on or my wedding ring. I take all that stuff off. I can't even sleep with socks on.
Yeah, so I'm expecting something similar to that. And it reminds me of Iwata's whole push toward healthier living and the bottom. I forget what they were developing for the Wii. The wellness sensor, was it?
Yeah, that thing was a bit ahead of its time. But yeah, it was something that you like clip onto your finger. From what I've seen of the footage, it looks more like a little disc you put beside you while you sleep. And it's like... Okay, well, that's something for my cats to knock over in the middle of the night because they take up the whole pillow.
I don't know. I'll give it a shot at least. But I think they're pushing even further into kind of lifestyle apps, so the lifestyle app space. And actually, that makes a lot of sense to me for Pokemon, because Pokemon is everywhere. You're always playing Pokemon now.
Yeah, and I mean, Pokemon honestly works well with fitness. Like, Pokemon Go, I still play that all the time. And of course, there was the PokeWalker for Heart Gold and Soul Silver. And that was apparently a very, very accurate pedometer.
And I think that Pokemon should be encouraging healthier living. I think any video game should be encouraging it. Next, it's going to be you're going to have a Pokemon app for your diet.
Oh, I'm going to get, like, shamed by Pikachu every day just when I need
you. You just put in your calories, and if you manage to stay under your calories and you're getting the right nutrients and everything, you get rarer and rarer Pokemon.
I was going to say, like, if you take in way too many calories, your little character on screen turns into, like, a Grumpig or a Spoink.
My problem is that there would probably be some kind of score for protein, and as a pescatarian, I don't get nearly enough protein.
Oh, yeah, that's, I know that, of course, it's possible to get, like, enough protein when you have that kind of diet, but you probably have to really work at it.
So, more pertinent, perhaps, to our audience is a little thing called Pokemon Home, which is a cloud-based solution for Pokemon Sword and Shield, which, very interesting, it connects Pokemon Bank, Pokemon Let's Go, and Pokemon Go all under one umbrella. So, effectively, what I'm gathering for Pokemon Home is with Pokemon Go, you'll be able to transfer monsters over to your Sword and Shield game, much like you could in Let's Go.
Makes sense.
And that will be how you round out your collection, perhaps?
I don't know if you remember, but I wrote a guide for how to transfer Pokemon across various platforms, including some of the older platforms. And it's a real song and dance. So even going back to the days when we had to use a cable to do basic transfers, and you had to, like, hope you didn't, you know, nickname your Pokemon a bunch of stupid things like I did, because there was not even a picture to tell you which Pokemon you were trading over. Yeah, just going to this whole cloud-based stuff is just crazy.
It's a good way to allow people to be able to get legendaries and things that would maybe ordinarily only be given away during special events over to Sword and Shield relatively quickly. And then, of course, Pokemon Let's Go, it will tie into that, so it will provide a bridge for people who got into Pokemon Let's Go and lets them go straight over to Sword and Shield. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was some kind of bonus or special, like if you transfer your Pikachu or Eevee from Let's Go, they'll have special abilities or something.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. I could see a lot of these sort of transfer bonuses happening.
By connecting to Pokemon Bank, this is basically showing that this is the way that you're going to get your monster from Sun and Moon and all the way back to Ruby and Sapphire over to your copy of Sword and Shield. So that would be the transfer solution. But here's the deal. Because Pokemon Home is not coming out until 2020, once again, with Sword and Shield, your Pokemon collection will not be available right away.
Nope, probably not. But at least when it's available, I can bring good old Nakamura into Pokemon Sword and Shield.
What's your thoughts on that, Nadia? Do you want to be able to transfer your collection immediately, or do you wish, or are you fine with just waiting?
I'm very much a waiter. I am not the kind of person who gets too attached to her old Pokemon. Again, my Incineroar, Nakamura, is the exception. I love him and everything about him. But otherwise, I am always fine with just like seeing what a new game has to offer. And, you know, I always like trying out the new starter to, like, you know, hunting for the new Pokemon. The only exception is if there isn't a Growlithe or an Arcanine, I'm going to have to bring that over, obviously, and I'm going to have to, like, you know, have a Riot if that's not available from the start. But yeah, otherwise, I'm fine with just trying out the new stuff right away.
I'm the opposite.
Yeah, I know.
Pokemon Sun and Moon was the first game in which I did not properly raise a Pokemon, and in many years. And a lot of that was down to, so I got through the entire game. I enjoyed it. Had a great time. And I think that I would have kept playing and continued to be into it if I had been able to transfer my entire collection immediately.
Right.
But I could not.
Right.
And as a consequence, I immediately lost all momentum. By the time that Pokemon Bank finally it actually happened and I picked it up again and was ready to get back into it, I was like, but I'm not really wanting to, so I moved on with my life.
Yeah, it took a while for it to be available in Sun and Moon, didn't it?
Yeah, like months. I don't think it became available until February or March of 2017, so.
Yeah, that's quite a long time. Hopefully it doesn't take that long.
Yeah, I think it will.
Unfortunately, I guess there's just so many bugs you have to work out.
I would say that maybe the best reason to do it is, I mean, obviously it forces people to get engaged with the monsters that are in the game rather than just transferring in all of their old guys. And also, if you play the game for a bit and then you set it down, this is a great way to refresh the game and make people want to get back into it.
That is true. Yeah, so you got a good point. I know it didn't really work on you, but I'm sure it worked on some people.
Another thing that they announced was Pokemon Masters, which is their collaboration with DNA. Mm-hmm. And this looks like a gachapon game, Nadia, because it looks more like a traditional Pokemon game than some of their other mobile efforts. It has pretty impressive graphics. It has seemingly all of the trainers from previous games, and they're also controlling monsters. And so it seems to me that either you're rolling and getting trainers from the various games from over the years, gym leaders, champions, rivals, regular trainers. I wouldn't be surprised if their bronze and silver variants were basically, you know, the kid who loves shorts.
You get the kid, okay, if you don't want to pay up, you get the kid who loves shorts, and you get Joey and his Rattata.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're just, those are the, that's the garbage that you just get back that you're just kind of throwing away. Or maybe they're your starters.
Uh-huh.
Whereas you got to put in, say, $150 to get Blue from Pokemon Red and Blue.
Yeah, I noticed their the key art they have for that game is very smart because it has all the cool trainers up front. You have, like, older Red, who I think is pretty cool. You have older Blue in the trailer for the game, which I also think is really cool. I think he and Red are married, but anyway.
Just friends, Nadia. They're best buddies. They're traveling the world. Don't even question it, okay?
They're traveling the world. Just, you know, happen to be together traveling the world. I saw Lance, who is my very favorite, and yeah, I would, like, spend money to get Lance.
Claire is my favorite.
Claire is from...
She is the 8th gym leader in Pokemon Gold and Silver, and she is either dating Lance or his protege.
Oh, okay, I remember her now, and yes, you're right.
She has a Dragonair, she has the cool blue anime hair, She was cool. She's your first example of a dragon gym leader.
Right. Isn't Lance the first? No, Lance was the Elite Four.
He was an elite gym leader. Right. He was a member of the Elite Four. So I'm curious to see how they handle the trainer aspect versus the Pokemon aspect. Like, will trainers have Pokemon built in that they're able to use? That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm also intrigued by this game because we do have a lot of mobile Pokemon games, but most of them are like, you know, oh, here's a puzzle game, or here's a game where you don't do anything at all and just let things happen, or, you know, you have Pokemon Go, which is also kind of passive. But this is a game that's actually about Pokemon battles.
I think that maybe a better way to do it might have been to just have the Pokemon be in the Gashapon aspect, but maybe they didn't want too much overlap with Pokemon Go. So
yeah,
that's why you have the actual trainers, which I suppose that makes sense. And then you can dress them up, and you can have special, like, wedding dress Blue and wedding dress Ash.
Aww.
Why are they wearing wedding dresses? Don't ask. It's a Gashapon game.
They just wanted to try it out.
And then Beach Misty. They'll have the beach theming.
Of course they will. Yeah.
And which will include special surfing Pikachu.
Nah, that'd be really cute, actually. And then I'd have to, like, dress up Lance, and he'd refuse because he's Lance and he's too cool for that. He's like, I gotta have my cape. Like, no, you gotta put on the funny costume now.
And they'll do winter and Easter costumes, so they'll be wearing bunny costumes and have special abilities. I'm pulling this all from Fire Emblem Heroes. I have, like, 50 different variants of certain characters. There's the holiday variant and the summer variant. And the...
and you keep buying them. And you keep drawing for them. People keep drawing for them. That's why they do it.
Anyway, I'm in trouble, Nadia, because this game is my weakness, and I'm totally going to play it. I'm going to play it way
too
much.
Oh, I'm absolutely
going
to play it. Yeah, I'm going to play it.
Still playing Fire Emblem Heroes. I can't stop.
Yeah, you got a problem.
I do have a problem.
At least you admit it.
All right, last news item. Larian has a big old 3 on their website, and people are, I imagine that we are going to learn whatever the heck this is during E3. Larian, of course, is the studio that developed Divinity Original Sin and Divinity Original Sin 2, games that I would consider the co-top 25 RPG. They're like, I think they're some of the newest games on this entire list. Divinity Original Sin came out, I think, in 2015, 2014, and Divinity Original Sin 2 came out about a couple years ago at this point. So, and I feel like we've criminally undercovered these amazing games that have become some of the best RPGs of the entire generation. But Larian has managed to get a lot of traction as a studio. And now the theory is that they're making Baldur's Gate 3, which was a rumor that got, well, they denied a few months ago, but I guess there was metadata or something in the website that suggested that there would be Baldur's Gate 3. So I guess we'll see, right?
Yeah, we will definitely see. I should actually text a really good friend of mine who was, like, so into Baldur's Gate that she, like, took a trip to Iceland, which I guess is related somehow. I forget how.
I only accept Baldur's Gate 3 if they find out how to get some kind of rodent pet in there again.
Maybe they will for you.
All right. So speaking of E3, let's continue on to our big E3 2019 preview. So don't go away. So Nadia, I think the first question that I need to ask is, looking ahead to what we're expecting for E3, especially from an RPG standpoint, how excited are you for this year's show on a scale of 1 to 5?
Oh, I'd say, I don't know, maybe a 3.5, 4-ish? Well, it's like I'm excited for Pokemon Sword and Shield, and I'm excited for the Final Fantasy VII remake. I'm excited for some surprise that we're going to get. I always feel like there's just a cool surprise going on. And I feel like I would keep my expectations around a 4-ish. I won't be disappointed.
My expectations are, I think I'm at a 5 at this point.
Oh, wow. That's pretty hot.
Yeah, I think I'm kicking myself for not going to this one, or at least not going there for long. I'm only going to be there for a day.
Neither of us are going to be there, and it's kind of the E3 that was meant for us.
Yeah, I mean, between Pokemon and Final Fantasy VII Remake and the new console announcement, I mean, and Jedi Fallen Order, I mean, come on.
Yeah, it is a hell of a one to miss.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of good stuff at this one.
Yeah, it's sad.
And who knows, this might be the last one.
For E3, you think so?
Nah. But I do think that E3 is definitely on the decline. And, I mean, it's really telling that Sony isn't going to be there, has literally no presence, and they are releasing a major game this year, which is Death Stranding, which traditionally would be shown in detail at E3 and is not being shown at all.
Yeah, although for a show that's supposedly on the decline, it always keeps us hopping every year.
Yeah, but Sony finally figured out that all you had to do was put out an 8-minute trailer for Death Stranding, and that's all you needed to do to own an entire news cycle.
Pretty much. They did really well on that, and not to mention, apparently that's one of their most watched trailers of all time.
Yeah, so why bother? So, like, if they had done that during E3, they would have had to contend with all the noise around, like, Pokemon and Microsoft and all that. And yeah, sure, you would have had a lot of eyeballs, but you're going to get a lot of eyeballs anyway because you're Sony.
Yeah, exactly. I think Nintendo really nailed down the formula with the Directs, and everyone said they were crazy at first, but no, they were right.
Yeah, I don't think Nintendo needs to have a booth there anymore. I mean, why even bother? You got your Nintendo Directs?
I guess because they always have enough hype for, like, say, like Mario Odyssey, that they have people lining up outside the booth to try it, and that's always good press.
I guess that is a good image of having people going completely nuts for these games.
Yeah, pretty much. That's why I'm actually surprised that we don't see, like, a Sony booth, like, even if it's a smaller booth.
They've been scaling back their presence for a few years now. I mean, for example, they had a big booth last year where with lots of kiosks where people could try out new games and everything. But as for new demos, they tend to be pretty cagey about their big stuff. They'll only show PSVR games. They were showing Tetris Effect. Maybe they'll give you a little bit of a hands-on with a game like Spider-Man or Horizon Zero Dawn, but not much of one. So I feel like they've been kind of stepping back a little bit as opposed to doing these huge blowout presentations for the media.
Yeah, they definitely didn't just like kind of drop it all at one go.
Though, you got to say, like some of Sony's, you could argue that Sony won the generation on the back of E3 because their E3 2013 press conference where they introduced the PS4 was one of the all-time greats. I mean, they just completely shut down Microsoft in one fell swoop. It was one of the...
They did. That must have been the easiest press conference for them ever.
It was one of the damnedest things I've ever seen to this day. I actually gasped out loud when they revealed the price point and just started going point by point, dunking on Microsoft with each one. It was amazing. I could not believe it. They just left Microsoft as a flaming ruin by the roadside, and Microsoft never recovered.
It was very, very much a repeat of, God, I can't remember what year it was when they revealed the price of the PlayStation and just kind of dunked on Sega and destroyed them because Sega was like, the Saturn's out now and it's $399. And I think Sony came to the microphone and said $299. And it was great. What year was that? Someone will tell me what year it was.
It would have been 96.
Yeah.
Okay, no, 96, earlier than that. Earlier
than that. Yeah, 96 or 95.
Yeah, it was 94. 95 when they came out, because the Saturn came out early 95, and that was the stealth launch.
Yes.
And the PlayStation came out several months later. And that was the moment that basically sunk Sega's console business. It was over after that.
Yeah, it was never the same after that, and just, it was not a good move on Sega's part on any level.
Yeah, retailers were so pissed that when it came to time for the Dreamcast a few years later, like, a lot of them would not even stock it, like, period.
Yeah, they really burned a lot of bridges.
Sure did.
Oh, Sega.
So, but speaking of new consoles, so one of the, probably the biggest story of this upcoming E3 is that we are expected to get our first look at Microsoft's brand new Xbox. And for RPG fans, I mean, there are rumors that Playground Games is working on a reboot of Fable. Mm. And while that is unlikely to be at the show, what I want to ask you, Nadia, is do you think Fable can be on the level of a game like The Witcher in terms of an exclusive for Microsoft?
In terms of like the sales and the buzz it would generate, or the kind of gameplay?
I'm talking about sales and buzz.
I suppose it's possible, although it's been so long since, I don't want to say Microsoft isn't relevant or anything like that, but it's been so long since they've been like the force that they were back in the 360 era that I feel like first they would kind of have to build themselves back up and say, hey, we're a major player again, because I'm looking at my, you're talking about, oh, new Xbox. I'm looking at my Xbox, one right now, and just the layer of dust covering it, and it's like, oh, yeah, Xbox, yep.
Yeah, so, I only ever play my Switch these days.
I play my Switch and my PS4, and that's all I really need, because it's not like the Xbox has a ton of great exclusives, but that could very well change with this system reveal come E3.
What do you think that Microsoft needs to get right with this console announcement?
Don't be cocky, and I think they've been taken down a few pegs, so they're not going to be too cocky. They need to have a decent price. They need to have, I think, exclusives are the most important thing. I think that, yes, maybe they're not the force they are now, but if they did have, hey, here's a Fable remake, and it looks really good, and it plays really well, I think that could be a major thing for them. Maybe not Witcher 3 level, but it would certainly be something. If they had something like that, and, you know, a little bit more of that going into this year, they could have quite the press conference.
I think that they need to be games focused with their new console.
Very much so.
They need to come out with good specs. They need to have the right price point. I wouldn't even announce a price point at E3. Like, don't make that the discussion. Leave that for later. Mm-hmm. You don't want people focusing on the discussion. You want them focusing on the games. And I think that you need at least one big splashy game. And I don't think it has to even be an exclusive. If you can get a game revealed at that particular press conference, that's what you want.
Thinking about it, I wonder how much this console generation of reveals will change, because it seems like the past few were always so focused on making game platforms multimedia, which, you know as well as I do, when you're just kind of sitting through press conferences about, oh, we can, you know, our new console can access YouTube and this and that, and that's like, which is great, but I care about the games, not the YouTube. And just given how successful the Switch has been without like any of that sort of thing for it, I wonder if, yes, we will see press conferences that focus on games now instead of like 10,000 apps that we don't care about.
Well, you look back at how Microsoft launched the Xbox One. I remember in 2013 watching that reveal and them talk all about how they were going to be focused around the living room and making a huge deal about how you could plug it into your cable box and everything. And I remember thinking at the time that felt dated, and this was before the true streaming explosion, right? People were already moving further and further away from their living rooms by that time. Cord cutting was definitely becoming a thing. And Microsoft badly, badly, badly miscalculated in trying to, as you said, turn into a multimedia machine, and also to focus around the Xbox around the Kinect, assuming that, we're just going to out-Wii the Wii. We're going to be this generation's version of the Wii. I think that's what they were going for. We're going to appeal to the people who bought a Wii. We're going to appeal to the people who bought the hardcore gamers who were dissatisfied with the Wii. It'll be a win-win. And instead, all they did was get completely mired in talk about the Kinect and all of their stupid cable thing. And of course, their always online requirements, which was a huge disaster. And that was the fact that it was too expensive. And yes, it wasn't as powerful as the PS4. And the PS4 was able to just come in and clean their clock with a very traditional system.
Was that the year that they brought in Cirque du Soleil?
Was it? Oh, man, I totally believe it. I don't remember.
I just remember everyone hating that so much, and like that was when I first heard about like Jim Sterling, because he's being interviewed, and someone said like, you know, and to someone asked Jim, what would you like to see, you know, for the rest of this E3, and he said, I would like to see Cirque du Soleil get buried alive.
You know, I wasn't at that E3 actually. That was in the very brief period in which I was not in the games press, so I was watching it entirely as a civilian. So maybe that. That gave me slightly clearer eyes, I think, about how the Xbox was being covered. On the other hand, I was also in the middle of all the comments and, you know, NeoGAF and Reddit and, oh, the gamer outrage.
There was a ton to go around. Yes, there was.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's any lesson to be drawn from that, it's that a really bad E3 can and a really bad reveal can completely sink your console for an entire generation.
Absolutely. And I think even though, as you say, we don't have that sort of clout behind E3 anymore, I think it's still the case.
So a few things that I'm kind of expecting from Microsoft. I expect that they're going to make a big deal about the whole cloud functionality. Yeah, that's going to be a thing, without really being able to answer questions about how they're going to deal with infrastructure. Microsoft is obsessed with always online, and this is how they're finally going to be able to do it.
Yes, but they're not going to call it always online, of course.
Yeah. Well, no. If they're smart.
If they're smart, we'll find out.
Well, Phil Spencer seems a little smarter than Phil Harrison, so I think he'll do okay. Phil Harrison is Google's problem now.
Good luck to Google.
Good luck to Google on that
front. And the Stadia.
Another thing that I'm kind of expecting, Microsoft to continue to make a big deal about its connections to Nintendo Switch and PS4, of all things. Specifically, Xbox Live Gold and such being available on those consoles. Maybe not PS4, but definitely Switch.
Definitely Switch, as well they should, because that is actually quite a big deal. And, you know, my 90s self can never foresee this kind of world we live in, where everyone's just, like, trading ideas like this. But, that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, and I think that we're going to see more former Microsoft exclusives, specifically indies, being announced for Nintendo Switch, games like Ori and the Blind Forest and that kind of
definitely.
Thing?
Definitely. Yeah, I definitely see Ori and the Blind Forest, maybe even the second one, Will of the Wisps.
And we just saw that the Xbox Game Pass was announced for PC. So, again, Microsoft is trying to basically be platform agnostic.
It really is, which isn't the worst strategy, really.
In terms of RPGs, I have some ideas about what might be shown at Microsoft's press conference. I'm not going to share them here. I don't think that we're going to see Fable. I expect that if anything ends up kind of headlining Playground Games, there's maybe one game that is an RPG, but I'm not going to say it. And the other might be Halo Infinite.
I was going to say, how about Eternal Sonata 2? New Blue Dragon, come on.
Oh man, Tales of Vesperia. We can go back to 2006. Blue Dragon 2.
Was there a 2 for Blue Dragon, or it never happened?
There was at least a spinoff. There was one that came out for
the PS. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of. Have like Jack Black sing that boss song again. Yeah. Hell, let's go back to 2006, man. We're nostalgic for it already.
It just speaks to the unpopularity of the 360 that freaking Hironobu Sakaguchi put out a Dragon Quest ripoff, and it still didn't sell that well on the 360.
Yeah, and it had Akira Toriyama's art, and it just did not go anywhere.
Yeah, it wasn't that good a game, to be fair.
I never played it. I haven't, but I never played it.
You should play it, because I bet you would like it, actually. It's a very traditional RPG.
I might give it a try sometime, and like I said, you have that like Jack Black boss song, so what the hell?
That and Lost Odyssey. Those are the two 360 RPGs that kind of have been lost to time.
So to speak.
outside of Microsoft's new console, I mean, Final Fantasy VII Remake will be at the show. At the very least, we know that it will be shown at Square Enix's press conference. It will be getting a whole bunch of time along with the Avengers. This is the moment we've been waiting for, Nadia. We've been waiting for this for 4 years at this point.
Good Lord. Yes, we have.
I believe it was Jason Schreier who said that episode one will be out in early 2020, which is tracks roughly what I have heard. And I have to ask, what are your hopes for the reveal, Nadia?
I hope to find out how long this episode is. Like, will it go to the end of Midgar? Will it stop before that? When are the next episodes coming out? Please don't make us wait 4 more years for the next one, which I don't think they will, but paranoia. What does Tifa look like? We don't know yet. We'll find out, I hope.
Yeah, I want to see more characters aside from Tifa, like Cid and Red 13 and that kind of thing. Maybe the Turks. It would be nice to see the Turks.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to see what the Turks will look like. And they'll probably look fine, because actually the Turks are popular characters in the compilation of Final Fantasy VII.
The Turks are popular characters in general, and I hope they get more screen time in Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, they're kind of funny. I like them.
One thing that always made me a little sad was that the Turks were great, but they were never that strong in the game. So I hope that they're more formidable so that they can live up to their fearsome reputation.
Yeah, you're right. They're supposed to be like these like major assassins, and they do all the wet work for Shinra, but they're real pushovers.
Yeah, totally. All the boss battles with Rude and all of that, really easy. Sang and Rude, and who's the guy with the red hair?
Oh, that's Reno.
Reno, yes. Reno, yeah. Rude, and then there's a new recruit, the girl.
Alina, I think her name is.
Yeah. I mean, I like their little story. It's fun, but...
Yeah.
And I love the dynamic. And honestly, I would play a spinoff starring just them, and I know one... I think one came out for the mobile game, for mobile, a long time ago.
Yeah, I think... something like Before Crisis or something like that. I think Red 13 was part of that one as well.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. So one thing that I would like to get a look at is I want to see how far this remake ventures into Wacky Town. Will Cloud be cross-dressing? That is a question for me.
Yes, and will he be able to visit the Honeybee Inn?
I don't think they will, because I think they want to be taken seriously. But yes. If they don't do it, if they don't do the wall market and everything, I think something essential will be lost.
Yeah, I feel like the cross-dressing will survive, because I don't think that Square Enix is above dunking on Cloud in his serious manner. Square Enix does occasionally dunk on their serious characters, like I've mentioned Dissidia, the second game, where Laguna basically takes Squall down a peg and makes fun of him. But I could see that happening, but... The Honeybee Inn was so weird. Like, I went to it once, and I said, I just saw that. I have no reason to go back here ever again. I never did.
So there is a scene, once Cloud is all dressed up and everything, you're put in a... If you don't manage to get picked by Don Corneo, you get put into a room with a whole lot of dudes.
Yeah, they are very... as you say, the implications are not good. And that's a scene I actually... replayed recently. I went to the Room of Shame because I couldn't be bothered like getting the perfume or whatever the hell I was supposed to do. And yeah, it's very much implied that what's going to happen next is not good.
Yeah, and they're all kind of walking at him like zombies, and it's kind of played for laugh.
Yeah, which it's like, I'm kind of glad I have a sword now.
And then they do the whole, he sheds the dress and everybody is surprised, and... man, that's going to be hard to carry off with in a full-blown remake. I got to say that much. Maybe I think that if they tried to recreate that scene, they would get a whirl of shit.
Absolutely, yeah. And absolutely they should. And I even think Japan, even though Japan is kind of behind when it comes to that sort of thing and like being... I just think that like even though we, you know, Japan still tends to play that kind of thing for laughs a little bit, they're not nearly as bad as they used to be.
I'm curious to see how far they venture into Wacky Town, and I'm interested to see the battle system and whether or not it's going to be kind of a boring hack and slash, if there's going to be more tactical, how does the magic and the materia work this time around, and I expect that we're going to get a fairly in-depth reveal on that front as well.
Yes, I'm definitely looking forward to all of that. I think it is going to be like the information deluge for Final Fantasy VII Remake, and it's about damn time.
Yeah, I mean, we've been waiting for this for a long time. And honestly, replaying Final Fantasy VII, the original, for Switch is making me more excited to play Remake.
Yeah, I'm definitely, like, I have, like, a really more of a perspective of what to expect from the remake, which reminds me, I don't know if they're going to tell us this at E3 or not, but, oh, God, what are they going to do about the Fort Condor minigame? It's terrible.
What are they going to do about the minigames in general? I mean, are they're they all going terrible. To keep them, right? I mean, are they going to keep the motorcycle chase and the snowboarding game, which was actually pretty fun? And
I did like snowboarding.
The squat minigame.
The squat minigame, the CPR minigame, the stupid dolphin minigame.
The submarine minigame.
What the hell was up with that thing? Like, you'll probably get to it at some point, but playing it, replaying it like I did recently, I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. And that's a pain in the ass because that sub has a piece of, like, giant materia. And if you don't get all the giant materia, you can't get the Bahamut Zero summon, which is the most badass Final Fantasy summon ever. Don't at me.
Man, there's... Oh, yeah, that's another question. How are they going to handle summons?
Oh, God, no skipping allowed.
I think there are a lot of questions to be answered, but I'm glad that we are finally happening. I don't know what's more surprising, Final Fantasy VII Remake coming out relatively soon, by all accounts, or Death Stranding getting it announced for 2019. I don't know which one I'm more surprised by.
I am honestly surprised that Death Stranding is coming in 2019. That just blows my mind. I thought for sure this is going to be one of those games where you see the teasers, like, every year, and it's just a fairy tale.
I thought maybe 2020, because just of how Kojima operates, and it seems like he has an unlimited budget and latitude to do whatever the heck he wants. But no, it's coming out. It's coming out in the fall. It's coming out in November, so it's like, okay. And same with Final Fantasy VII Remake. Going into 2019, like in January 2019, if you had told me Death Stranding is coming out this year and yes, Final Fantasy VII Remake will be out roughly this time in 2020, I'd be like, no way.
Yeah, it just goes to show anything is possible in this universe.
Yep. Okay, another big game that will be at E3, Cyberpunk 2077. Nadia, what do you think of Cyberpunk? Do you have any interest in this game?
I don't know. First of all, when it comes to CD Projekt Red, I'm terribly behind. I want to play Witcher 3 very much. I will play it. But it's like, first of all, when it comes to Cyberpunk, I'm very picky to begin with. And just going by the previews we've seen and the videos we've seen, there's a whole lot of, like, it just strikes me as it's trying very, very hard to be cool and edgy. And I could be totally wrong. I probably am totally wrong. But just the little bit we saw, I wasn't necessarily enthralled.
It's basically an updated Deus Ex, it sure seems like, but with an open world, kind of like a expanded open world, and that Witcher and that CD Projekt writing that we've all come to expect. So I'm excited for it, and I think that it will be really good. It's disappointing that apparently it will not be hands-on.
Oh, it won't be. Yeah, that's right. It won't be, will it?
Yes, and it's not coming out this year, according to Jason Schreier, but that's not surprising.
Not surprising, yeah.
At all. I was not expecting it to come out this year. I mean, maybe I entertained some hopes that it would come out this year, but...
You always have to have that hope.
That doesn't seem like CD Projekt's MO. I think they'd rather put it out in the spring, kind of like what they did Witcher 3.
Yeah, although, I don't know, what I've seen of Witcher 3's writing seems infinitely better than Cyberpunk's, just from my angle.
One thing that I am interested to see, will it be confirmed for next gen? Last year, a lot of people were looking at it and thinking, this might look a little too nice for current gen. This might be running on next gen hardware.
Right. And we are very much getting to that point where we can expect games to straddle that line and have both generations serviced.
I would also hope that it is being played on the new Xbox and that we can get a good look at it on that platform.
Oh, now that would be a good idea for Microsoft.
It would be. I think that it is a clear win if Microsoft manages to get Cyberpunk to appear at its press conference and ties it closely to the new Xbox.
Mm-hmm. That would be very smart of them.
Okay. And finally, Pokemon. Pokemon looks to be a big part of this show's, at least at the Nintendo Direct. Pokemon traditionally hasn't been part of E3, not really. Pokemon Let's Go kind of broke the mold last year and was actually playable. So I have to ask, what does this version of Pokemon need to prove, Nadia?
I feel like it needs to... it's funny because I think that one thing Pokemon fans really, really want is to see that we're going to have like a more robust single-player experience. And I don't know if there's any way they can prove that over E3. Maybe they'll tell us. I don't know. I really liked Pokemon Sun and Moon's single-player. I like that they did change it up a bit. But Sword and Shield seems to be returning to the traditional gyms and stuff, so I'm curious to see if this sort of backsliding has a purpose. Of course, sometimes Game Freak does things because they just do things, as we know. But kind of still a little disappointed they got rid of the encounters on screen. A little bit disappointed that gyms are back, but for all I know, it could all be fine and great and dandy, and I guess that's what I want to see for out of Pokemon this E3.
I want to see that it's up to snuff on Switch. Want them to show that they are creating a full console-sized experience because, like it or not, people are going to be comparing it to the biggest RPGs that come out this year. Pokemon's competition is no longer stuff that's on the 3DS. It is Witcher 3 and other games that are coming out. I think a question mark is graphics. I think that in some ways the graphics were very nice, and some ways the graphics really were not nice. And I hope that they've really given a nice round of polish for the next showing of this upcoming Pokemon game.
What I liked most was how it's kind of an uneven world. Like, you finally have things like hills and stuff like that. I think the landscape looks really nice. What kind of fell flat for you?
Definitely the ground terrain textures, which look like they're from the GameCube era. I mean, look at it during the battles and look how bad the grass textures are. They are not good.
Right. Yeah. So something like that. I could definitely see something like that, you know, being added later. So yes, this would be the show to prove, hey, what you saw was just an early build. Here's what, you know, you can look forward to this fall.
I remember Pokemon Let's Go not looking great around E3 and looking much better by the time release came around. So I do think it'll get that extra layer of polish.
It probably will, yeah.
One thing I'm definitely going to be asking about, as always, endgame. Will it have good single-player endgame? What are they going to do with online? I think Nintendo's online has been a bit of a shit show. I mean, we had your Mario Maker 2 coverage went up earlier this week, and it was confirmed that you will only be able to play with randoms online. You will not be able to play friends. I mean, if Pokemon's... online play is as limited on the Switch as it is on the 3DS, I think that will be a huge lose.
Yeah. Although I seem to remember later Pokemon games on the 3DS having some fun stuff. Like, I remember being on the subway once and just kind of playing Pokemon battles with someone there. That was kind of cool. But yeah, Nintendo Switch Online has been just like, not that we're paying much for it, but, you know, we're still paying something. Please give us something, Nintendo.
I mean, it's not like Pokemon didn't have any online components at all. I mean, it had events and mystery gifts, and there would be, you know, online competitions that in which you could battle against people and that thing kind of thing. But the regular kind of random matchmaking has really never been that great and has tended to be fairly painfully limited. I would like expanded. First of all, I would like a reason to be able to play online. You know, rewards for playing online, in-game tournaments, any way that you can make the random matchmaking a lot more interesting, I want to say. I would like them to dramatically expand the customization. And traditionally, I feel like the barrier of entry to their online play has been a little high, so I'd like them to lower that for the Switch version. They've done a lot of interesting things over the years. One of my favorite examples is in Black 2, White 2 had Join Avenue, in which if you connected with somebody online or locally, their avatar would come to your city and potentially even open up a shop, which I loved. I thought that was a brilliant idea, and I hope they have that for the Switch as well.
I love that kind of stuff that they when they have it in games, like Dragon Quest IX's inn. I love that inn. Like that where you like you join people, where you'd meet people and they join your inn. Like it's a small thing, but you're right. It kind of gives you this sense of like community.
As for the other RPGs that will be at E3 2019, one that stands out to me is Fire Emblem, Three Houses, which will, in all probability, have a big part to play at Nintendo's booth since it is coming out this summer. We talked a little bit about Three Houses when some information got revealed in Famitsu. I confess to be a little ambivalent because I don't know where the heck they are taking this thing.
Right, but I'm sure we'll find out by E3.
How about you, Nadia? Are there other RPGs that you're really excited to see during E3?
I would like to see a little bit more of Link's Awakening, which is more of an action RPG, but
It's not an RPG, like Nadia. Gah! We had this whole discussion.
I'm mentioning it now. I want to see Link's Awakening. I don't care if it's an RPG. It's close enough. It's an RPG to me, damn it, and I want to see it at E3. I want to see a surprise. Like I said, I always like nice surprises.
I would like to see a surprise as well. I would love to come out of E3 not expecting a particular announcement and being like, oh, I am so pumped for this this game. Insert game here.
Yes, those are always the best E3s.
I totally agree. Another thing to keep an eye out on is Oninaki, which is the new RPG by Tokyo RPG Factory. I did not have a lot of expectations for this one, but when they showed the initial trailer, I'm like, oh, this is actually pretty good looking this time. Okay, maybe they seem to have stepped up the production values and maybe the game will be better this time around.
Well, God bless them. They keep on trying.
Shenmue 3 will be at this E3, Nadia.
Eh, great. Good for Shenmue.
Complete lack of enthusiasm on that front. Monster Hunter World Iceborne is getting a big showing at Capcom.
Mm-hmm. Might be a good time for me to get back into Monster Hunter. I don't know.
Yes, Nadia. It is always a good time to get back into Monster Hunter.
Cat wants to turn everyone to filthy addicts.
And Vampire the Masquerade, which I don't think has been getting as much coverage as it should have been. But I think it has a lot of promise and... if they really knock it out of the park, it could be a really exciting and great remake or update, not sequel, I suppose, of one of our top 25 RPGs, the original Vampire the Masquerade. So,
yeah, I was going to ask, is this one, like, I wasn't 100% clear if it's a remake, a update, a sequel?
It's a sequel.
Or something else. Okay.
It's in a totally different location this time around. Instead of LA, it's going to be in Seattle. But it borrows some elements from the original Bloodlines. Like, it starts the same way, but... All right, some questions for E3, Nadia. Will there be an Assassin's Creed? And I ask this because Assassin's Creed is an RPG now.
I guess it is, isn't it? I'm not sure about Assassin's Creed. Maybe another Watch Dogs?
Will Starfield or Elder Scrolls 6 get a mention? We know that they won't be at E3.
I can see Starfield getting a mention. Elder Scrolls 6, probably not. I have a feeling they don't want Elder Scrolls 6 to overshadow Starfield.
Maybe Starfield, probably not Elder Scrolls 6.
Yeah.
And when I say mention, I mean, I don't know, we might get a teaser?
If that.
I don't think either of them are going to have much of a presence, because I think Bethesda doesn't really want to talk about them right now. I think they would rather be talking about Doom.
Yeah, definitely. Does Bethany Esda have a press conference this year?
Yes.
Okay. So that's where we'd see something if we saw anything.
Nadia, as you may know, Square Enix is putting out an Avengers game. Do you think it will be an RPG?
So Square Enix and Avengers. I completely forgot that they're working on that. Will it be an RPG? Well, Square Enix, so I suppose it's very possible. That'd be interesting.
I heard that it might... So here's a comparison that I heard that I think is... I'm trying to kind of work out in my head still. Kind of tracks with what people were saying, which is at the E3 Coliseum presentation, it was supposedly going to be a four-player cooperative game with single-player elements. I heard it compared to Overwatch.
Really? That's weird. Okay.
But I wouldn't be surprised if it turned out to be actually something more akin to Destiny or something to that effect, in which you are... playing as a hero, and it's a kind of an online platform game.
Yeah, which is like, yeah, sure, why not? I'm even though I like Marvel movies, I'm not like the hugest like MCU fan, so I'll just kind of observe it from a distance, and if it seems to be really fun, I'll dive in, sure.
And the last question is, will the rumored George R.R. Martin RPG be revealed at E3? I think it will be. I think it will be there, and it will be a big part of the show. Like, I think it will be one of the biggest stories of the show.
Yeah, I'm actually very intrigued about that. I would like to see it revealed during the show. I want to see what it's about.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. I mean, it could be really good or it could be really bad. I mean, ultimately, what RPG do you have highest hopes for at E3? Has it been announced? What do you want to see?
I don't know if it has been announced. Like I said, I'm always up for a surprise, but otherwise, I'm most excited probably for Final Fantasy VII Remake. I'd say Pokemon is a close second. And I have my heart open to all other possibilities.
I'm really excited to see more Cyberpunk. I'm looking forward to seeing what might get announced on the new Xbox. I'm hoping that it will be something RPG related. I don't think we're going to get a glimpse of it, but I would love to see a glimpse of something that maybe Obsidian is working on or Playground Games is working on for their new corporate masters in Microsoft. I mean, if there's any time to show something off or tease something, it's during a Microsoft reveal, right?
Yeah, definitely. But we'll find out pretty soon.
I guess we will. All right, Nadia, that's all of our E3 preview. If you have any thoughts or questions, send an email to cat.bailey@usgamer.net. Leave a comment on our show notes or send a message on Twitter. All right, let's continue on to the mailbag. Okay, Nadia, last week we continued our console RPG quest, which we have on pause right now. A lot of nice comments about it right now, by the way. I've gotten some nice letters from people saying that they're really enjoying it. Thank you very much. I'm having a fun time doing it, too.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. I particularly like the NES episode, so if you haven't listened to that, go back and listen to it.
So, in the last episode, we talked about the Sega Master System and the Sega Game Gear and the relatively limited RPG saga or legacies of both. But we got a few notes on that. Neil Cameron says, "So I never got Phantasy Star for the Master System. If I recall correctly, it was hella expensive. The game I can point to as ground zero for my love affair with RPGs was also on the SMS, and that was Ys Book 1 and 2. It was a very basic battle system where you walked into your enemies, but damn if that game didn't haunt me as I worked my way through that game. It was a few years later, after playing this one, someone showed me the TurboGrafx-16 CD version of the game, and my mind was blown. Voices, animated cutscenes, and redrawn sprites. It was breathtaking, but I will still always think fondly of my first RPG." Yeah, we talked a little bit about Ys, and we goofed on it for basically being a game where you bumped into people. But hey, I mean, it couldn't have been that bad because it sure spawned an entire series.
It sure did. And like I said, like most of those games have excellent remakes. I think Ys 3 was remade as The Oath and Fel'Ghana, which was just a great game. So by all means, go back and play those. And our next letter is from Sir Laguna, who says, "Okay, just heard the Axe of the Bug God about the NES RPGs. Great episode. My experience with the genre on that console was Captain Tsubasa Volume 2, Super Striker. The anime was incredibly popular during the 90s here in Colombia, so every kid got this game even if it was only in Japanese. We loved it, and we learned what every option and every string of kanji meant so that we could play it. Writing down the passwords correctly was an epic task, I bet. I actually love hearing, like, stories about just like outside of North America and even like, you know, Europe and the UK about like how, like what consoles people played then and how they got by language barriers. One thing I was actually talking about recently when I was at an event in Montreal was I was talking about how games are localized. I said to someone there, I said, "Do you guys get Parisian French? Or do you get Quebecois French?" Which is, it actually is quite different, you know, very different slang, very different everything. And I had this really interesting discussion about how Super Mario Galaxy, some people in Quebec thought that maybe Nintendo was pandering a little too hard towards their slang and what have you, as in they just kind of did not lay off. I actually saw a screenshot where, like, Toad is sleeping and he's dreaming of poutine, so that just tells you everything. So
that's awesome.
So I just love hearing stories like about, like, you know, gaming in other cultures and localization and stuff like that. So yeah, thank you for that.
I think it's interesting that it wasn't even localized. It just got thrown into Colombia. Be like, here you go, kids. It's a
game.
It's about soccer. Enjoy it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's soccer. It'll sell. And it did, apparently.
Captain Tsubasa is an interesting case, by the way, Nadia, because it's basically a menu-based RPG, but in soccer form.
Oh, really? I remember when they tried to bring over, what was it, what was it called?
Oh, Inazuma 11.
Inazuma 11, that was it. And they did that once. I don't think they ever did that again.
Yeah, it didn't really catch on, not the least because soccer isn't extremely popular in Canada or the United States. But
no.
Captain Tsubasa Volume 2 is kind of neat in that, so you see the characters running around, and you can choose a command from a menu, and they will do that. And then they have to build up, I think, will. And once they build up enough, they can take a super strike, like one of their special attacks at the net. And it actually kind of reminds me of version of Blitzball.
That's actually really cool.
Yeah, so as somebody who really enjoyed Blitzball back in the day, I was amused by it. And also, Captain Tsubasa had really good graphics, and there apparently is a version for mobile, which I actually downloaded, and I might be playing at some point in the near future if I ever can wean myself off Fire Emblem.
I just love that soccer is so popular in parts of the world that it's like, what can we do with soccer now? Let's make an RPG out of soccer.
Calvin Redburn 14 was referring to the Game Gear, said the Game Gear was a big, bulky battery eater, but the roguelike Dragon Crystal made it worth it. Its chippy theme still randomly starts playing in my head. And it stays there. And that's okay, because it's awesome. I miss Dragon Crystal, but if it's a roguelike, that's kind of an interesting thing to have on a Game Gear.
Yeah, come to think of it, sometimes people will bring up, like, okay, I had a Game Gear and it wasn't great, but it did have Dragon Crystal. So it was definitely one of the more well-loved games on that system. Sergeant Smash says, I actually just went on a splurge of Master System games back in March for Hardcore Retro Gaming's Master System Month. I didn't find anything that blew me away, but I definitely found a few gems like Asterix and the Mickey Illusion games. I've already played through Phantasy Star, good, but not my favorite, and I finally finished Golden Axe Warrior, a game that could have been better than Zelda, but has some absolutely baffling design decisions that bog it way, way down. Yeah, I forgot about Golden Axe Warrior, but that was a thing, and it was not a good thing.
All these games that want to be Zelda and utterly fail to recapture the magic of Zelda, much like Pokemon.
Exactly. It's like, hey, it's all about the game design, stupid. Not the gimmicks.
Turns out these games are extremely hard to design, and they're classics for a reason. And on that note, Axe of the Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Once again, subscribe to us. I'm on Twitter at @_Capbot. Nadia is at Nadia Oxford. Subscribe to our newsletter, which goes out every Wednesday. And keep on an eye on US Gamer for all of our E3 coverage. We're going to have a lot of interviews. We'll have a lot of hands-on. We'll have a lot of commentary. This podcast will have information. We'll be on social media. All that jazz. It's going to be a very busy week. It's going to be all hands on deck, Nadia.
It sure is. It sure is. It will be all hands on deck. Pirates off the port bow.
I feel exhausted just thinking about it, but be ready to go on that journey with us. But until then, thanks for listening. For Nadia and myself, we'll be back next week. And until then, happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons. Oder Anna? Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser Bestes.